Hello and welcome to Bite Back Chats Books. This week we're turning our audio spotlight on the issue of elitism. It's become such a toxic word in the past decade, but what does it actually mean? And who is behind this toxification? Here to fill us in is Eliane Glazer, a journalist and author whose new book Elitism is about just that. Welcome, Eliane. Eliane Glazer, welcome to the Bite Back Virtual Podcast.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on. We're here to talk about your book, which is coming out soon, which is called Elitism, A Progressive Defence. And, well, we've all read it, but we're very excited for it to be coming out into the world and for other people to read it. So I know that elitism is a buzzword at the moment, and yet people don't really kind of know what it's fully about and kind of the implications attached to the word, and that's all very interesting and kind of knotty stuff, really. So before we dive into that, I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a journalist.
Yeah, so I guess I'm always interested in what's not being said, rather than the pylons that we see on Twitter. I suppose the more obvious critiques. I've always been interested in how power operate, and in particular about the kinds of arguments that powers, you know, whether that's corporate power, financial monopolies, concentrations of wealth, you know, and their political allies. I'm always interested in how power legitimates itself and gains public license. And that includes the more sophisticated and perhaps, you know, below the radar ways in which the powerful forces in our society acquire public legitimacy. So I guess throughout my writing life, I've written about those kinds of strategies that are used. So I wrote a book called Get Real, which was about how corporate and political elites use strategies like invoking people power and the empowerment of ordinary people, and they use strategies like emphasizing interactivity, citizen engagement, and things like corporate social responsibility and greenwash and astroturf campaigns and all these kinds of
astroturf campaign that I've interested.
It's a fake grassroots campaign. So it's when big corporates, for example, create the false impression that there's a kind of groundswell of support for their product or their cause. And so it's really a co-option of progressive ideas and progressive techniques. And you see this more and more, I think, so that, you know, whereas in the past we might have seen political or corporate elites, you know, what I really call the real elites, you know, the real powers in our society. I guess in the past, you know, that their exercise of power was more straightforward. It was a more kind of us and them sort of division between the people and these powerful elites. But I think what's happened now is that those powerful forces now recruit the public to be on their side, and they use quite sort of underhand or hard to spot techniques to gain our consent for them to monopolize wealth or monopolize political power. So really, I suppose my work's always concerned with trying to detect and call out those more hard to spot strategies. And I guess I started to spot anti-elitism over the last few years in particular as being the latest strategy that corporate financial and political power uses to really consolidate power and wealth with the public's consent. And we see anti-elitism, you know, everywhere in the media, you know, the talk of liberal elites, journalistic elites, you know, the elite commentariat, and this has really come out of right-wing populist discourse, but it's become really widespread in the media and in politicians' speeches. And actually, it's not now even restricted to the right. You hear people who are actually characterised as the liberal elite themselves talking about the liberal elite. You know, there's okay, a kind of... Yeah. There's a real loss of confidence on the part of journalists, cultural institutions, writers, and political leaders themselves that actually, that perhaps they are the real powers. But I suppose what I'm arguing in the book is that there's a kind of a grand deceit going on, that the people who are the real powers, the real elites, have encouraged the public to believe that they're not really powerful, and that they're actually the big bogeymen, if you like, are these professionals, intellectuals, journalists, and cultural practitioners.
Yeah, so elitism has kind of been toxified, and liberalism especially, because in your book you talk about being a liberal, but it seems over the past few years that liberals have kind of become a public enemy number one of sorts. So can you talk a bit about, I guess, how you notice this happening, and then what forms this like liberal toxification is taking?
Yeah, so I guess I would probably be categorized as a member of the liberal elite. So I'm a journalist, an academic, and you know, all of these categories are now, they have become toxified. And I think this is it's hard to talk about a deliberate strategy without being accused of being a conspiracy theorist, but you can trace the evolution of anti-elitism throughout, through the work of think tanks, particularly on the right in the US and the UK. And there has, I think, been this deliberate strategy to switch the terms of debate away from economic inequality, which I regard as the really important fault line, and onto cultural values, education, and really that, and it, I guess another word for this is the culture wars. But I think that doesn't, the phrase culture wars doesn't quite capture what's going on. That really, you know, there used to be this division between left and right and rich and poor. And now we're being told, you know, not just by right-wing think tanks, but really by when we read liberal commentary at or broadsheet commentary, that that the new fault line, the new division is along the lines of identity. You know, what level of education do you have? What do you live in, a city or a town? What's your cultural values? And we see this division obviously with Brexit, and it's incredibly damaging, because you can no longer have a healthy democratic debate between the 1% and the 99%, if you like, or between left and right, because those are supposed to be now obsolete categories. Now that the opposition is between the educated and the less well-educated, that's incredibly toxic divisions. And you also see, because of the rise of populism, we're now encouraged to oppose our political leaders. So there's this division now that's opened up between politicians and the people. And, you know, and you see even left-wing politicians talk about disparagingly about the political elite or political class. And, you know, the fact is that politicians are, you know, often more economically privileged than even than they were in the past. But that's actually a circumstantial fact. It's not necessarily the case that if you hold political office, you should necessarily be posh, you know, or rich. So, but those two things have been mixed up together, political office on the one hand and economic privilege on the other. And the same, you know, with education, educational excellence on the one hand and social and economic privilege on the other, cultural high standards on the one hand and again privilege on the other. So because these things have been conflated, the public is being encouraged to destroy, you know, political institutions, educational excellence, high standards. We're encouraged to level those things down. But actually what I'm arguing in the book is that that's going to result in a society where we have a huge amount of social and economic inequality. But actually what's being targeted is our education, our culture, and our political institutions, and those things are actually really valuable, and those things are being kind of brought down and dumbed down. I mean, there's lots wrong with political institutions and, you know, democratic institutions and politicians. There's lots wrong with these with these structures and these individuals, and politicians are not necessarily acting in the public interest. But the solution, I argue, is not to say, well, they are the elite and they must be brought down. The solution is to try and encourage them to be operating in the public interest.
Yeah, it's such an interesting duality, especially with this government, because it is, I'm not sure if it's unashamedly populist, but it certainly is a populist government, which, you know, kind of rose to power on the idea that they're the everyman, and yet Boris Johnson is extremely privileged. So there's a very, very strange kind of doublethink going on there. So where do you think that leaves the government? Is it kind of, do you think there's a danger then of kind of governments like that just reserving power for the upper classes and the current like elites, and then leaving the rest of the public less well off?
Yeah, I mean, it is, there has been, I think, this grand deceit that's gone on. So right-wing populism, because we've been led to believe that it's your level of educational attainment that matters and not how rich you are, that's why figures like Trump and Farage can make common cause with, you know, so-called kind of ordinary voters, because they say, well, it doesn't matter that we're rich and you're not, because we share the same kind of educational outlook and cultural values. And this is, you know, hugely damaging, because it means that we can no longer have a conversation about the forms of inequality that really matter. So social and economic inequality, and actually the whole issue of poverty is kind of then out of the picture. So what you have then is ballooning inequality, and we've seen that, you know, concentration of wealth has become even worse during this crisis, and yet the finger is pointed at professionals, experts, journalists, cultural figures, and this is while, you know, newspapers are folding, arts organisations are cutting their staff. So it's really damaging. I don't know what the answer is with politics. I think it's just to kind of restore. I mean, I do think that what's happened in political culture is that left and right as terms have become irrevocably toxified.
Yeah, very much.
So I think we're going to have to, I would say, ideally we would invent new terms and reframe the political debate, but to kind of keep this sense of what's really important. You know, what are the divisions that are really important? You know, there is a real division based on economic interests, which we've lost sight of. And I think, I think political figures like Bernie Sanders, you know, even though he was the one that got away really in American politics, I think he's really shown how it's possible to reframe those old fault lines for this new age. And I think that we've got lessons to learn really from that.
How did he do that?
Success. Well, I think he was just incredibly good at articulating, you know, what are essentially old concerns, which are about inequality and monopolization, but reframe them for new times. So for example, on the issue of work, you know, the old division between labour and capital might be obsolete, but because now we live in this era of precarious work and the gig economy. But he managed to update those timeless issues of imbalances of wealth and power, and apply them to the world that we live in and the lives that people lead. So I do think it's possible to have this kind of productive politics, but I think that depends on getting beyond this really damaging opposition that we've got between ordinary people and elites.
Who do you think might be the modernizers then to move UK politics forward?
Well, I don't feel particularly pessimistic at the moment. I mean, you know, I don't want to get too far down into party politics, but you know, Keir Starmer obviously has some really positive qualities, but I guess that Corbyn, you know, he did articulate something of that really popular progressive agenda that Sanders did, but interestingly, Corbyn himself was anti, you know, he talked about the political elite and the political establishment. So like I say, even politicians and commentators on the left have, I think, fallen into the same trap of disparaging this political elite But and that's leading to this kind of public cynicism and anger towards the political establishment. But actually, political institutions, democratic institutions, government, the state, you know, these are deeply unfashionable terms, but these are the institutions that really have the centralized mainstream macro power to enact large-scale social change. And, you know, we've seen that so clearly with this crisis, but just generally. And I think that we have to find some way to rescue and reinvent the way the public thinks about these so-called elite institutions.
To make them fashionable again.
To make them fashionable again.
So in terms of then the real elite, can you talk a bit about the people that you see as the kind of the real elites who are manipulating our attention and deflecting it from them?
I guess the real elites is our tech monopolies, big corporates, and their political allies, you know, who are funded by shady donors, you know, oligarchs owning newspapers. You know, that whole kind of web of kind of big tech, right-wing politics and offshore finance that we're really familiar with, you know, through the work of journalists like Carol Cadwallader and other people who have, you know, who have exposed how wealth is being centralised and monopolised and moved offshore into private hands. And this has been done it's been enabled by this populist political establishment, which centralizes wealth in private hands, or enables wealth to be squirreled away into private hands, but does so with the public consent, because they've managed to somehow persuade us that they're on the side of the ordinary people. You know, and you saw that rhetoric in the general election, you know, Boris Johnson waving a fish around in Grimsby, you know, wearing a hard hat and a man of the people. You know, but we saw this actually before Cameron, Call Me Dave, you know.
A bit of a bacon sandwich.
Yeah, and even back to John Major with his getting on his soapbox in Luton election campaign, and, you know, Thatcher, the grocer's daughter and so on. So this right-wing populist tendency is not new, but it has become utterly dominant, I think, in our politics. And I just think that it's really hard, even though we know that a lot of cynicism amongst the public, we know this, that something fishy is going on, but it's just really, I think what I've tried to do in this book is to disentangle the terms of the debate, because even while we know that we're being lied to, I think that the terms like elite and elitism and political elite, liberal elite, they've been so bandied around that what we have to do is just go back and separate out what the terms mean. You know, to ask, who is the elite? How powerful actually are they? Where is the real power operating? What does the word liberal mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's only by actually really digging down into these terms and sorting out what they really mean that we can start to say, right, okay, well, how can we see a way out of this mess?
Yeah, you prompted me slightly there. I was going to ask you, these elites then, so we kind of know that they're powerful companies like tech companies, people that have been kind of quietly amassing power in the shadows, as it were. And still, like, people don't really know a lot about them or just how much power they have. So can you talk a little bit about the power that the elites have and whether you think it can be taken back?
Well, I guess it's you know, these big corporates and hedge funds and big finance and tech moguls, and it's you know, I think we're kind of familiar with who these people are and the fact that they are really wealthy and powerful. I mean, you know, Nigel Farage, you know, he has himself photographed in a gold-plated lift, and Trump, is photographed literally with $20 bills hanging out of his back pocket. You know, they don't hide their wealth, but it's so interesting, isn't it? It's like they're saying, look, we have nothing to hide. Unlike, you know, you sort of professional bodies or newspapers or universities who are, it's you that have dirty secrets, not us. You know, we're not corrupt, but they're flaunting their wealth and their power. But I think what I'm really interested in, what I keep coming back to, is what enables the public to let them get away with it. And of course, you know, we're disempowered to some extent structurally, and it's hard to, you know, political mobilization is a tricky thing. But I think it's really the arguments that are used to legitimize that concentration of wealth and power that I'm really interested in. And I see anti-elitism as being really one of the key strategies that's now being used, and it's being used not just by the right-wing populists, but by liberal, so-called liberal commentators who are buying into this idea of a comfortable liberal elite. And actually, so for example, we talk about the you know, sort of left behind voters in the red wall constituencies and so on. You know, there's a reality aspect that, of course, these communities are disenfranchised and disempowered and so on. But I think that progressive commentators and politicians have become so terrified and so keen to be, you know, perceived to be supporting these people that they don't feel able to speak up and, you know, call out the way that these people are being used by populist politicians who really don't care about their material welfare, but they're appearing to make common cause with these so-called ordinary voters by suggesting that they share the same set of views on, say, culture or education. So, you know, really by taking aim at the so-called elites, you know, professionals, journalists, cultural figures, writers like me, you know, by taking aim at these, what I would regard as really not non-elite individuals, the real elites are able to get away with it.
And as they do, they defund institutions like, you know, political institutions, universities, and also the arts. And as someone who's worked for the BBC, I'm quite interested to kind of know your opinion on, as the BBC is one of the institutions that kind of comes most under fire for being like liberal, lefty, you know, it does seem that a lot of the fire and bile is concentrated on the BBC. So can you talk a little about the impact that anti-elitism and populism is having on the BBC, or the impact that you've seen it have?
Yeah, I mean, I'd rather not comment specifically about the BBC as a broadcaster, but I think that institutions which are the targets of anti-elitism have really struggled to hold their nerve in the face of these attacks. And, you know, I think I'm really worried by the fact that values like public service broadcasting are now being redefined as market populism. So serving audiences, you know, bums on seats, what's really popular, audience figures and so on. So I really want high quality cultural institutions to hold their nerve and to put out content that they believe is good and not fall into the trap of serving, you know, what is perceived as the market interest. And, you know, and I think that if you look back at the history of institutions like the BBC, you know, it's quite surprising, really, the kind of avant-garde content that was really popular and attracting huge audiences, you know, towards the end of the 20th century. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, Play for Today, The Singing Detective, which I've been watching in lockdown. And these are not middle-class cultural products, actually. They're, you know, often, you know, working-class talent or self-proclaimed working-class writers, and really aimed at a very broad audience. So, you know, I think that we've forgotten this really strong tradition of working class intellectualism and avant-garde art, which was made by, you know, non-middle class people, and aimed at a really broad audience. We've forgotten that tradition because now we just associate high culture and avant-garde art with middle class audiences, and we associate it with social privilege.
Sure. Do you think these institutions and like journalism risks being dumbed down in that case by anti-elitism?
Yeah, I think we've seen a huge amount of dumbing down and across the educational, media and cultural sectors. And I think that there's a move towards this endless soliciting of audience feedback, you know, tell us your views. Artists and cultural practitioners have to fill out these endless forms to try and get subsidy for their work, which, and those forms ask you to prove that you're having impact on communities and improving mental health and well-being and finding new audiences. And even though that sounds really worthy and positive, it just means that cultural and media organisations are unable to just concentrate on making good content and high quality cultural products, but they have to, in a sense, justify their output in these either economic or kind of social work terms. And I think that that's, you know, really that kind of loss of nerve on the part of media organisations and cultural organisations is really a consequence of this anti-elitism, that there's a sense that these organisations are somehow comfortable, complacent, pompous. They need taking down a peg or two. You know, we can't afford them in this age of austerity. And I think that perception that they are this comfortable elite is just so damaging and so false, because those are precisely the organisations that are under such financial pressure. And, you know, actually in an age when we have such opulence, you know, we don't see this wealth, but it's really easy to forget that we are the sixth richest country in the world. And there is, you know, untold wealth in private hands and offshore. But it's just about a conversation, really, about what we value as a society, that we choose not to rescue these cultural institutions that give us so much pleasure and enrichment.
Yeah, absolutely. Drawing the conversation to a close in that case then, what's one thing you hope people will take away from reading Elitism?
Yeah, I think I would like people who feel like they are the so-called elite, I want them to have the confidence to defend what they do and defend what's really important, and not to let the financial elites and their political allies to use these false ideas of being fair to ordinary people, which are lies anyway, you know, or that this myth that there's not enough money in the kitty, to use those false ideas to destroy what we really value. And I think that particularly during this crisis, so many people have discovered the value of professionals that keep us safe, you know, doctors and scientists, you know, the politicians who make essential decisions, you know, ideally in the public interest and protect our rights, the writers and artists and journalists who produce the content that we, you know, rely on to know what's happening in the world, and also to, you know, to kind of really enrich us and enrich our lives. Now, all of those qualities are under threat at the moment. So I really want this book to provide some of the counter arguments to the prevailing anti-elitism that's really destroying what we value.
Great. Well, that's a good note to end the conversation on, that case. Well, thank you so much for appearing on the podcast. Yeah, Leanne, great to chat to you. And
great. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to another Bite Back podcast. If the subject of elitism and elites has you fired up, then why not head to bitebackpublishing.com and find out more about Eliane's book, Elitism, A Progressive Defence. It's out on the 18th of August. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Until next time.